Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 3, Networking. Usual question. How are you going, Jay?
I would have to be twins if I was any better, and the world couldn't stand that, so we'll just leave that one as it is, huh? Spare the world.
Before we proceed any further, we have a new student. Well, he's been hanging around on the periphery now for about 2 or 3 weeks because Stuart joined us just after Chapter 1 and got down the last 2 lectures and wasn't able to join us last week. So I'd like to make welcome Stuart Hanley, who's from New South Wales. And if you can just introduce yourself, Stuart, for about 30 seconds, 30 to 45 seconds, you can then say you're officially welcomed into our class.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Stuart. As Elise said, I live in New South Wales, in the Hunter Valley, New South Wales, Australia. It's great to be here.
And you're in the class to just hone up your network skills or something? Learn a little bit about setting up in the home and small office network?
And I'm very interested in this concept of online, online lecturing, online learning. And I would like to think that one day I could contribute to it.
You just never know. We are off and after new instructors. So there you go. So there'll be a couple of new ones coming. Yes, we were all once students. How about that? We survived. And also on the channel, who you may not have yet met, is Joseph, of course, Mario, Gary, Gary from Texas, Kylie from New Zealand, myself from Melbourne, who you know, and Jackie from Arizona. So we're all here, all set to go. Are there any questions about the previous 2 chapters, or are there any questions about this chapter for those of you? I know some of you have actually read ahead, so go for it. No questions, no comments, no feedback. I guess, Jay, we should be right to start.
I imagine.
We start at 3.1.1, and we talk about introduction to networks. What is a network? Basically, the first thing that comes up here in my notes is ask students to think about networks that you use. Now, all the time, you're often using networks, and sometimes, well, I guess we all know, but your layperson out there on the street may not know. So what are some of the networks that we sort of use in our everyday life, guys?
Radio.
Yep.
Telephone.
Internet,
yeah, good stuff. And playing video games with people in another country. There's people doing that all the time, using networks all the time. There's also other networks like social networks or even business networks where you can have a group of people, you know, sort of in a room or in a, you know, some sort of forum, you know, hooking up and discussing, you know, businesses and that sort of stuff. I like the way about listening to the radio and all that sort of stuff. All these activities depend on robust and reliable networks. Basically to connect, you know, people and equipment wherever they are in the world. Now, many, many people use these sort of, you know, facilities like radio, television. They don't even think about the network that's behind it. Of course, we've got computer and data networks, television networks. All the TV stations in America and Australia are all linked up and networked. Of course, you get regular and high-definition broadcasts. And, of course, you know, some of which are all, you know, they're all hooked up with satellites these days. And the good old public switch telephone network, of course, which we're all familiar with now. And that connects callers and allows modem connections by the good old plain old telephone system. And, of course, where would we be without the good old mobile, or as the Americans call it, cellular network? Just think of all those text messages that wouldn't have anywhere to go. Basically, communications in the 1990s and before required dedicated networks for voice, video and television, of course. All of these different networks required different types of devices to, you know, in order for people to connect. You know, telephones, computers, television sets use specific networks and protocols and boxes to connect to their respective networks, and never the twain shall meet. These days in the noughties and teens, it's going to be very different. We talk about this wonderful thing known as convergence. These new technologies can provide us with a brand new type of networking. Unlike dedicated networks, these new converged networks are capable of delivering voice, video and data services all at once and all over the same medium, like the same channel on network structure. You know, your cable network, for those of you who have got cables, a very good example of this, of course. You know, you can have high-definition television broadcasts on the same coaxial cable as that as your high-speed internet and your telephony or telephone. Ooh, I should have broken this up. Basically, you can watch video live broadcasts on Even your computers, make a phone call. I've got voice over IP on the computer as well. So I can do everything. I was actually sitting here watching my high definition television service on this monitor that I'm borrowing from a friend last night, just to see what the monitor was like. So all this for convergence of technology make it all possible. The benefits of networking. Can anyone give us any idea of the benefits of networking while I scroll down?
Sharing resources.
Yep. Anything else?
Lowering costs.
Yep, costs. Anything else?
Yeah, how's that done?
Increasing productivity.
How is lowering costs done? What's that about?
Sharing peripherals like printers or scanners so different clients can use the same unit instead of buying separate ones for each.
Bingo.
Yeah, that's exactly. One thing. What about saving on the cost of long-distance phone calls? I mean, you know, we talk on Skype. Lisa and I talk halfway, three-quarters of the way across the world. Can you imagine what that would cost if we had to phone each other?
Yeah, it's got to the point now. I pick up my VoIP service and just ring Jackie and don't even think about it. She's on the other side of the world. You know, because I got having the VR, the voice over IP. If I don't want to rely on Skype, because if she's not showing us online, I'll just I'll ring the house and I just do it without even thinking now. I've got even programmed in as a pre-select, so I just have to dial 7# and bingo, up her number comes, you know, and it's free. So yes, it makes it so that we can communicate with customers, or that for Jackie and I, we can communicate with our friends/business partners, etc. Advertise and sell products, order supplies. So as Jackie just said, it's a lot more efficient and cheaper than traditional forms like, you know, snail mail and telephones. Consolidation, storage, and access to informational network servers, which we'll come to shortly in the lecture. Basically, business and Soho networks usually provide a shared connection to the network. What's a Soho network, folks, other than a suburb in London?
Small office and home.
Small office, home office, yep, that's the one. So, you've got this small office, home office situation connecting you to the internet, which is a big, bad, nasty world out there full of, you know, thousands of computers all connected to this wonderful, big, huge, wide area network known as the internet. So basically, the internet is often referred to, it's considered as a network of networks. And I think there's something in the test about that, so just be careful, folks. Okay, I think we've already discussed how we can use networks in our daily lives. Okay, the next section here, we're discussing small home networks that connect small groups of computers to one another, and a whole lot of them are usually connected to the internet via a shared connection or an integrated services router. These small offices can then, you know, either connect to the internet or obviously connect to a corporate network based off, you know, some distant suburb somewhere. You also have medium to large networks that are often used in corporate environments and schools. These can have many locations with hundreds and, you know, even thousands of users on them. So basically it says here the internet is a network of, you know, hundreds of millions of computers here. Basic network components. Any comments before we go on to that? Okay, these components can be based into four main categories. Hosts, peripherals, and networking devices. I would have marked this up differently, but anyway. Okay.
And you forgot network media. Sorry about that.
I did too. Sorry about that. And networking media. Yeah, good-o. Okay. My apologies, Jay. Okay, so we've got four main categories. Hosts, shared peripherals, networking devices, and networking media. Okay, of course, the ones that you're most probably familiar with are hosts and network peripherals. Okay, can anyone tell us the difference between a host and a peripheral? And I know there's a couple of you out there who have actually read ahead in the chapter and know this.
Host is connected to the network, but a peripheral is might be shared, but it's not, doesn't have a direct connection.
Yep, and a host also has. What does a host have that a peripheral doesn't have?
A host directly connected.
IP address.
You got it, Gary. Yep, that's what we're looking for. Host has an IP address. Examples are hosts are personal computers and networked attached printers, as opposed to peripheral printers, which, you know, this some of us were alluding to before. As Kylie rightly said, shared peripherals are not directly connected to the internet, they're connected to hosts. So a shared peripheral relies on a host, and that might be a scanner, digital camera. I'll usually don't see too many scanners shared out. I suppose you can, but printers are often the thing that most people come to mind when you talk about shared out peripherals. The host is then responsible for sharing that peripheral across the network. Generally speaking, a host has software installed that enables you to share out the peripheral across the internet, across the local network. Usually Windows is very good at doing this. And then all that sort of is built into most operating systems these days. I've just given those examples, so I'll just skip ahead here, Jay. Okay, network devices really are devices that connect other devices, mainly hosts. Network devices move and control network traffic. And can anyone give us an example of a network device?
Routers, hubs, switches.
Gee, Joe's read ahead. You've got them all. You've got the copy open in front of you, have you, Joe?
That's a negative.
Well, that's good in a way, because you've remembered. Okay, let's discuss a few of these things here. There are other things as well that interconnect hosts, and that is, of course, the network media. Yes, that big chunk of blue cable between you and your switch or router or whatever you have. Basically, this provides a connection between hosts and network devices, and it can be wire, copper, fiber. It can be copper wire, or it can be simply wireless technology. Back to our devices, some of these can play more than one role. Pretty much a printer directly connected to a local host or a printer is a peripheral, but a printer that is connected into the network is a device and can actually participate into the network. Oh, boy.
Actually, it says it's a host. It participates.
Yeah, I know. It's just that I usually break the sentences down a bit. Sorry, Jay.
Actually, I didn't do that for some reason. It just did it on its own.
Okay, yeah, it's a bit tricky.
I have no idea why it did that, because I didn't. So, yeah, I know what you're saying. I didn't do it that way.
Yeah, okay, yeah, fair enough. Basically, all computers that participate directly in the network is known as a host. In modern networks, hosts can act as both a client and a server in one hit, and we'll discuss some of those differences shortly. Usually a client or a server, but there's no reason why a host can't do both. A server is a host that have software installed on them that enable them to, serve out web pages or email or other services, for example. So each of these services require different server software. Now, a good example of this would be, say, my Challenger server that a few of you here on channel are familiar with. It serves up web pages like ciscovision.org. Jackie and I got a couple of small websites running off it. It also is the same server that provides me with email, and it also provides some of you login access to send and receive files, on which some of you do. And basically, these are all different services running on the same server.
Another server and client arrangement with which you might be familiar is the one we're using right now to conduct this class, Ventrilo. And the server is called darkstarllc.com, well, v47.darkstarllc.com. And you have the Ventrilo client on your machine, and so our messages go through the server and come to your client and into your ears.
And in a minute, we might get you to ping it. So there you go. Now, can we have some example, guys, of some client software? And I'm sure you use all this every day. Outlook Express. Sorry, Kyle, you're a bit low in level there.
The client we use on Challenger is SSH.
Yeah, no, that's a protocol. You're using a client called WinSCP.
Oh.
Which transmits using the protocol of SSH as opposed to FTP. But yes, you use a program which is a file manager protocol that actually also handles FTP if I had it switched on, or if you had an FTP site, you could also use WinSCP. But what's another client bit of client software that a lot of people are using?
Your web browser.
Got it, Joe. Well done. Okay, so what about Ventrilo? Is that a client, guys?
Yes.
Yep, sure is. As Jackie Riley pointed out before, she was talking about v47.darkstarllc.com, which is the server in Perth that the Cavi people are using as the central hub for us all to connect to, for us to communicate with on. Via. So basically it says here, let's have a look at an example of email. The email server runs email server software. For example, Challenger runs a program called XM, and a lot of Linux systems run a program called Sendmail. It also runs another program called Dovecot, which allows the client software like Outlook Express or Outlook to connect and pop off the email messages or to connect to an IMAP share. So there's a couple of different pieces of software here running on my server, but suffice it to say, it runs software in that enables clients like the people out there using Outlook, etc., or Outlook Express, or Eudora, or whatever the client of choice is to connect. The web server runs server software that enables it to serve up web pages, like every time you go www.cisco.com, there's a web server software there. I'm not sure what they're using, I'll have to check, that would serve up the web pages. In my case, if you go to, if you go to jawsscripting.lonsdalemedia.org, my Apache server on Challenger will serve up the Jaws Scripting website. And no, we shouldn't be into cross promotions here, but hey, who cares? Okay, what else we've got here? File server and file access client. Yeah, let's get back to something that Kylie mentioned. Kylie was talking about, she mentioned SSH, which is protocol, but WinSCP. I've got some software here that runs, basically serves up files whenever Kylie connects to my server, and she's running the client software being WinSCP, and she just gets an Explorer-like interface that she can navigate through the directory structure. Jackie uses it too from time to time, and they can put stuff up there or get stuff down, etc., based on what access they've got. So basically it says here, computer with server software can provide these services to one or many clients, often simultaneously. So whilst Kylie's out there using WinSCP to access a file system, Jackie could be actually logging onto her website, the Jaws Scripting website, and making changes on her website. And Mario could be there actually being a Jaws Scripting participant. He could be down there downloading the latest lecture, and all this can be going on while I'm asleep. So there.
When she ever does it.
Oh God, you're dumping me in here, Jack.
That's rarer than water on the desert.
It's basically saying here in a small business server might be able to act as a file server and to serve out local files to the participants in the workplace, manage the email, and have a small web server on it. You can actually run client software on the server. Like, I still have a web browser or two installed on Challenger, and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, I'm just going to skip that bit. Peer-to-peer networks, guys. Can anyone give us a good example of a peer-to-peer network?
Kazaa.
Yep, Kazaa. Anything else?
Messenger.
Yep, MSN Messengers and all that sort of stuff. In some of the instructor notes, it talked a lot about Napster, which was sort of peer-to-peer, but sort of also client-server, because everyone had to connect to a central server, even though the music was being shared out peer-to-peer.
It was a central server to which people connected, but the music, the users shared it out peer-to-peer. Now, there's no peer-to-peer component about it. It's just a central server where you buy the music from. Because they got sued and they lost. And the reason why they lost, guys, was because the court ruled that because there was a centralized server to which people connect, that Napster was responsible for the content on the server.
Yes, the Ninth Circuit Court. So that's what nobbled Napster. BitTorrent, of course, is all purely peer-to-peer. So there's no control over that. But in the context of... Go on, Jay.
And by the way, I mean, unless you think otherwise, guys, peer-to-peer is not always... And BitTorrent is not always illegal. Often you can download, like Linux distros on BitTorrent and other things that are perfectly legal to download. Don't completely give it the bum's rush and the bad rap.
Hear, hear. Exactly. Now, I've downloaded one of my GRMLs off BitTorrent. In the context of our discovery course, it talks about peer-to-peer networks. It can be just small groups of computers, like in a small office, and you might just have the computer in the secretary's office connected to the boss's computer, and you've got a little peer-to-peer network, and if you have any more than three of them, you've got to get a hub, any more than two of them, rather. Often once the business grows a bit more, it's often better to have a dedicated server. Now, what are some of the disadvantages to the peer-to-peer network, guys? I'm not sure whether I've got that in the notes today. We should probably do a bit further down. Here we go. It is, yep. If I scroll down a bit, here we go. Well, there's actually some advantages first. What are some of the advantages, folks?
They're easy to set up.
Yep, anything else? That's a good start.
Low cost.
Yep, a few of these people are on the ball while they've been reading their notes, either or both. Can be used for simple tasks such as transfer of files and sharing printers. Some of the disadvantages, gang?
No central administration.
Yep, anything else?
minimal security.
More expensive?
No, they're not more expensive, but they're not scalable. So, you know, you can only get so far and then that's it. The other disadvantage is that all devices may act as clients and servers, which might be convenient, but that because it has a lot of extra network traffic and the devices are serving up files and receiving files can slow the performance of the network down. Microsoft operating systems like Windows have built-in server software that allows it. Allows, usually because of licensing, no more than really about 10 connections to your machine. So if you've got a Windows XP box, you can have a few people hanging off that before you have to go and organise a more dedicated server. This enables you to share files with other people on your network. When your computer shares out a file, of course, or a folder, and I know some of you have done this in the 3-point whatever it is labs, you're acting as a server when you share out a folder or a file. Most operating systems like Windows, Linux and Mac OS have client, you know, built-in software that allows you to connect over the network to a shared resource like a computer sharing files or folders. The principles, I've got to the end of this. I can go back and have another orange juice and clear my dried throat. Are there any questions before we go into the principles of communications with Jackie?
If any of you guys have ever hooked up a little home network, then likely what you have is a peer-to-peer network. And, you know, you can do some things with it. You know, you can share folders over the network, as Elise pointed out, and you can, you know, share printers and stuff like that. When people used to, you know, like run across the office to give a floppy to somebody or whatever, or run into the bedroom to give your hubby a disk or whatever, we always call it sneaker net. And with a home network, you know, you save a little wear and tear on your sneakers. So anyway, anybody have any questions about that? Because I'm about to start with the principles of network communication. And ladies and gents, here's where it starts getting into the nitty-gritty. Okay. The primary purpose of any network is to communicate information. I've heard it said that the first network to ever be recorded was the Tower of Babel, where a bunch of folks got together thinking that they were going to build a tower to heaven, and God said, we can't have this, and took their language away. So they couldn't communicate information anymore. Say that again, Elise?
I said, yeah, look at the mess that caused. No protocols.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Basically, no matter what people are doing, from very elementary things like what's for dinner tonight, to very advanced scientific and mathematical concepts, we need communication. We need a way to communicate information. So the basic building blocks of communication is a message, right? You know, some kind of message or information that has to be sent from a person or a device to another. Obviously, the methods are going to change as technology advances, maybe. I mean, if it's people, they're probably going to, you know, have it relatively stable, depending, I suppose. But, you know, basically it's going to be talking unless you want to do sign language or Morse code or Braille or something like that. But anyway, a message really has to have three elements in common. The first is the message source. Right now, I am the message source because I am talking to you. I'm transmitting. I'm sending. This can be, you know, a device too, like on a computer network. The second element is the destination or receiver. You folks are the receivers. I am transmitting, so I am the transmitter. You guys are the receivers or the destination. So we can talk about source, which is the message sender, destination, which is the message receiver. The third element is called the channel. And the channel is the pathway over which the message can travel from source to destination. Right now, the medium is a whole bunch of things, probably. It's wireless coming out of my internet, my network to the internet, It's probably traveling via fiber optic and maybe some copper across to the Dark Star LLC channels, which, and it's probably traveling again over fiber optic and copper back to your places. It may be getting to you either wirelessly or through copper wire. But either way, the medium is basically the channel over which the message is sent. If I am talking to you and you are in the same room, then the medium is the air, the sound waves being transmitted, you know, through the air. These are crucial concepts. I repeat, these are crucial concepts. You will need to understand this terminology very thoroughly in the discussion that follows. So, does everybody understand this concept of source or transmitter, destination or receiver, and channel or pathway or medium? Does everybody understand this?
Ten.
Yes.
Yes.
We're alone,
all right.
Jay.
Yep. I guess so. Let's talk a little bit about human communication a little bit, okay? When people talk with one another, there are a variety of rules that two people follow in order for a message to be, understood. Some of the successful rules are you have to identify who's the sender and who's the receiver. Now, right now, this is pretty obvious. I'm the sender, you guys are the receiver. Because A, I'm autocratic, and B, I'm the teacher right now, and C, you guys are just out of luck. Right? But
the
truth of the matter is, these roles can be reversed, because all someone has to say is, stop, I have a question. And probably I will obediently cease my palavering and let you talk, all right? But still, the role then of sender and receiver has changed, and a new and the identification of that took place. In other words, I would stop and say something like, yeah, so-and-so, go ahead, what's your question? And then it would become clear to everybody that the sender has changed, all right? The second thing that has to occur is an agreed-upon medium or channel. Now, we can do this like over Ventrilo, which was the agreed-upon medium. We can get together for coffee and discuss it face-to-face. We can call each other on the phone or over Skype or whatever. We can do it by email, but either way, there is an agreed-upon medium for doing this. The next thing is there has to be some kind of an appropriate communication mode. You know, spoken or written or illustrated, if a person, say, can't read or doesn't understand a person's language, whatever. There needs to be some kind of common language. Now, we're here speaking English, and so that is our common language. If I started speaking Norwegian, for example, which I could do, but the problem would be is that the majority of you, if not every one of you, would not be able to understand what it is that I'm saying, because the language would not be common. That's what happened at the Tower of Babel, wasn't it? That the languages got messed up, and so there was no longer a common language. Grammar and sentence structure. What happened? Okay, and this is fairly interesting, because in certain languages, you can actually say, the dog bit the man, okay? And everyone would know that it meant, you could actually say the man bit the dog, but the article you used to between the of the subject and the of the object would make it clear that what you're really saying is the dog bit the man. You're not saying, I would be able to turn the subject and the object around in some languages because of the articles they use. German is a really good example. If I would say, den Hund beißt der Mann, everybody would know that I meant that the dog bit the man. If I would say, on the other hand, if I would have the object of, well, Dane is an object, and it always means an object. So no matter what I said, no matter which way I turn it, if I use Dane to represent, you know, in front of Mon, then everybody would know that the dog bit the man. And it doesn't matter the order of the sentence. In English, it obviously does matter. Do y'all understand the fact that, you know, in some, however you do it, there has to be an agreed upon sentence structure. I mean, in German, you can get away with reversing it. In English, you can't. But either way, it has to be agreed upon. Does everybody understand that concept?
You're talking syntax.
Yes.
Say again, Kylie.
You're talking syntax.
Yeah, pretty much, syntax. Another thing that has to be taken into consideration is, if I start to give them the lecture real fast like this, do you think y'all could understand me for very long, or do you think it might make you a little bit tired out and make you kind of want to quit this lecture? What do you think? Well, we
quit
might
the
get
lecture,
to...
isn't it?
Yeah, it would make you want to quit. I think it would, all right? And the reason is that speed makes it very difficult. I mean, if it's too fast, it makes it very difficult to understand the person. Timing, too. If I say one sentence, and then I stop and I say another sentence, and then I stop and I, you know, that's kind of rough, okay? Those kind of hesitations, it makes a person want to say, Jay, are you still there?
So time out.
Timing also is an important element of this communication process. And you're going, what does this all have to do with networks? And let me tell you, it has everything to do with networks. Just think for a moment about what would happen if no protocols or rules existed to govern how people communicate. Would you be able to communicate or understand somebody? If you have an email that has absolutely no punctuation, for example, how easy is that to read? Just curious.
Not easy. There's a great example in the notes people haven't read.
It's a pretty big garbled mess. And the whole translation of this.
Okay, I can do that one too.
Translation of all this crap.
It is very difficult to understand messages that are not correctly formatted. Do not allow the established rules and protocols. The structure of the grammar, the language, the punctuation, and the sentence. Make the configuration humanly understandable for many different individuals.
Apart from my jaws going quite quickly, did anyone understand that?
I got it.
Well, it's in your notes, you know. Okay. So, these rules, another synonym for these rules that we talk about are protocols. You're going to be hearing an awful lot about protocols in this chapter and in subsequent chapters of discovery. And so we figured that probably the best way to actually acquaint people with protocols is to first talk to them about how they exist in human communication, and then talk about how they exist on the network, okay? Protocols are specific to the characteristics of the source, channel, and destination of the message. For example, rules governing a phone call are not necessarily the same as those for writing a letter, for example. Protocols define the details of how messages are transmitted and delivered. And obviously, I mean, if I'm going to make a phone call to somebody, that's far different. You know, I can pick up the phone and dial the number. It's far different than writing a letter where I have to, you know, address an envelope and go to the post office or put it in an outside door clip for the mailman to pick up or whatever. Okay. Protocols have certain things that are applicable to them. For example, they include message format, message size, timing, encapsulation, encoding, and standard message patterns. Basically, a lot of the rules that make human communication understandable also apply to computers. One of the first steps that you have to take first is to encode the message. Now, encoding can be writing or pictures or spoken language, etc. It's the thought base, or it's the process basically of converting your thoughts into to language or symbols or whatever it is for transmission to another person. Decoding reverses the process. So let's say if I write a letter to you about something, I'm encoding my thoughts onto the paper using language. Okay, you get the letter, you open it, you decode my thoughts by reading the words and translating those, you know, letters and symbols into words that you know. So, for example, if you have somebody watching a sunset, as they say in the notes, and calling someone to describe how nice it was, they have to convert their thoughts into words, and then the words are spoken into, you know, the telephone using the kinds of inflections, or, "God, it was so great, you should have seen it, it was just glowing off the clouds, this bright red, orange," you know, that kind of thing. Okay, so there's inflection and words. The person listening then, you know, decodes what you've said, listens to the inflection and everything, and decodes what you've said in order to picture the sunset. Now, encoding also occurs in communications with between computers. It has to be appropriate to the medium. What that means is that, for example, if I'm sending it by Ethernet network, it's going to be different than it would be by token ring network and that kind of thing. We'll get into those, you know, concepts later, but it does differ depending on the medium involved. Messages that you send across a network first have to be converted into bits. And depending on what the network is, each bit is converted into a pattern of sounds or light waves or electrical impulses, whatever the network medium is.
Obviously, it's one stuff here, folks.
What?
Good old layer one stuff here, gang.
Yeah. Obviously, if it's a telephone network, it's going to be converted into sound. Obviously, if it's a, you know, like copper network, it might be converted into electrical impulses, etc. The destination host has to then receive it and decode the message in order to actually receive the message. Does everybody understand this concept?
Yep.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So, in a computer situation, then PC1 is going to send a message to PC2. And so it'll begin the communication as the message source. It encodes the message and sends it to PC2. The digital signal is a data stream that PC2 receives. And there's a channel, which is the transmission medium between PC1 and PC2. The receiver receives it and decodes the message so it can understand the content. The receiver is called the destination, and that's where the decoding occurs. Does everybody understand this so far? It's not terribly difficult.
Yes.
Yep.
Cool. Yep.
All right. So the next concept we're going to discuss is message formatting. Obviously, messages need to use a specific format or structure. You would agree, I think, that if I wrote a letter to you, it would be very different in format than if I phoned you. And the two might be very different from if I emailed you something. Would you all agree that there's differences in the format that messages take?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
So, when a message is sent, it has to be, it depends on the type of message and the channel that's used, obviously. An example that the notes gives is letter writing, okay, that there's a specific format. That you have to have an identifier of the recipient, like, you know, Mr. John Brown, 344 12th Street, you know, New York, New York, 10012. All right. A salutation or greeting, like, dear Mr. Whatever, dear Miss Whatever. The message content, a closing phrase, like, sincerely, an identifier of the sender, which is the signature. In addition, you know, one of the things that you're going to have to do with the letter is to mail it. And in order for that to happen, you usually put it in an envelope. The computer term for this would be encapsulation. Okay? I'm putting one kind of data inside of another kind of data. Okay? The envelope has to have the address of the sender and the receiver on it, each of which has to be located in the proper place. The proper place has been determined that the return address goes on the upper left and the sender's address goes on the bottom right. If I reverse these two, the chances are I'm going to get my letter back, or it won't even leave the box, because they'll say, you know, it's going to her, whatever. You know, one of the things that I get a kick out of the most is that the NLS, you know, they send you these cassette tapes, or they send you these cartridges now that they have the digital cartridges. But they don't really have a way for you to determine which way is the library's address and which way is your address. And so if you happen to drop the label, you know, if you don't turn it over properly, or you drop it or something, it very well could end up coming back to you.
And here's what the Australians did about that. It's very simple. They got a pair of scissors and cut one corner of the tag off. So if you turn the label over, you knew that your address was, the cutoff was actually, like they just cut one corner of the card, so you could just feel where that was. And if you knew where that was in relation to the address, it was fine.
Yeah, well, what can I say?
There you go. They can put a man on the moon, but they can't address a label.
What can I say? Okay, so putting some kind of data or message format inside of another kind of message format, like a letter in an envelope, is called encapsulation. And de-encapsulation occurs when you reverse the recipient. The recipient reverses it, i.e. take the letter out of the envelope. Does everybody understand this?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So just as like an envelope is encapsulated, or a letter is encapsulated in an envelope for delivery, each computer message is encapsulated in a specific format called a frame before it can be delivered. Okay, a frame acts like an envelope. It provides the address of the intended destination, and it provides the address of the source. Host, the host that sent the message, all right? Obviously, the format of the frame is determined by the type of message and the channel over which it's communicated. And understand that messages that are not correctly formatted are not delivered. All right? And there are such things as malformed frames and that kind of thing that you can get into. I don't know if any of you have ever like downloaded a file and tried to unzip it and gotten things that say CRC error or cyclic redundancy check error or file is corrupted or whatever. But obviously what happened in a situation like that is that one or more of the message frames got corrupted and that error could not be recovered from. Does anybody have any comments on that? Okay. Well, then let's talk about the components of a frame. We're into networking now, guys. In case you hadn't realized it, I snuck up from behind you, and we're into networking. So, the first thing that we want to talk about is the frame addressing. Frame addressing consists of a couple of things. It consists of the physical or hardware address, also called the MAC address. Okay? This is going to be both the address of the destination and the address of the source. Now, what do I mean by physical hardware addressing? You may remember that we talked about this in ITE1 a little bit. And we told you, for those of you who took our class at that time, that for every network interface card, there is a unique 48-bit hexadecimal code that represents the hardware address. Hopefully, no two devices, or at least no two devices on the same network, have the same hardware address. Hardware address is also known as physical address, is also known as MAC address, or media access control address. Do you guys remember this from IT1?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. We also have an end of frame, or an end of message indicator. Okay. We have the encapsulated message and a start flag, a recipient destination identifier, and a sender source identifier. All right, and encapsulated data bits. You will also remember that in ITE1, we talked a little bit about IP addresses. We told you that IP stood for Internet Protocol. And we told you at the time that an IP address was a 32-bit binary number that represented a computer's location on or address on the network. Okay? It's different from the MAC address, which, as you know, is a 48-bit hexadecimal code. And you've seen IP addresses expressed as like 192.168.1.1, for example. We called those numbers octets because each of those numbers represented a byte, and each of those bytes represented 8 bits of binary data. Have I lost those of you who didn't take ITE1 with us?
How are you going with that, Stuart?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay. Right. I think everyone else here did take IT1 with us, didn't they?
Okay.
But so there's also people out there in listener land who may not have, so yeah, sorry, Jack.
Yeah, really. Well, I mean, you know, I understand that, but you can only do so much.
That's right.
So the message is encapsulated, you know, in this frame. Obviously, the network devices and stuff on the network have to know how to route these messages. You know, it doesn't just happen miraculously, folks. The network devices have to route these messages. For example, if I want to talk to my husband's computer, one of the things that I might do is that I might use what's called a ping command. And I would type ping Carl McBride, because that's my husband's computer's name. It's real original. And so when I do that, the ping comes back and it says, reply from Carl McBride, 192.168.1.3, I think it is, I don't know. And then it gives me a reply. Well, how did that know? I mean, did it just occur in the out of the blue? Well, we'll get to that. But just be advised that, you know, you have to have the source, both the IP and the MAC address, encapsulated into the frame, etc., in order for a message to arrive at its destination. Is that clear?
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, let's talk about message size a little bit. Can you imagine if we just gave this whole lecture from start to finish, barely took a breath, never paused between sentences, never let you guys ask any questions, etc.? That would be a pretty big thing, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be an awful lot of material to digest. And it would probably be an irritant, too. First, because it would be boring. Second of all, if you had questions, you couldn't ask them. And you'd think, man, I'm not even getting my money's worth here. Third of all, you'd probably get tired of listening to one or the other of us talking. I would. Or imagine what would happen if your Discovery One notes were written as one long sentence, no punctuation, no paragraphing, etc. Okay? Obviously, when people communicate with each other, that's not the case. We break our communication down into smaller sentences. And hopefully, you know, there's an interchange back and forth of sentences of reasonable length. Obviously, in network, you know, parlance or terminology, the rules that govern the size of frames that are sent across the network are pretty strict and stringent. They may also be different depending on the type of channel used. Frames that are too long or too short won't be delivered. The size restrictions placed on frames therefore require the message sender to break messages into sizes that meet the minimum and maximum requirements for frame sizes. Each piece is encapsulated in a separate frame with the address information, etc., like I told you before, and sent across the network. And you guys have seen this. If any of you have downloaded files, you'll see a progress bar. What that is just, you know, X number of frames being received, you know, by whatever downloader you're using. At this point, back at the receiving host, the messages are de-encapsulated in order to be processed. Does everybody understand that concept?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
Another factor that has to be taken into consideration when sending messages is timing. People use timing. For example, if I pause a long time, somebody might say, "Jay, are you there?" Or let's say you ask me a question, and I don't say anything, and I don't say anything, and I don't say anything, and I don't say anything. Well, eventually you get tired of waiting. You say, wait a minute. Either she didn't hear me, or she's not there, or she's ignoring me. And so what do you do in a situation? Well, you might try to ask your question again, assuming that I didn't hear you. Or you might go on and say, well, heck with it, it's not important. I'm just going to leave it be and not mess with it. Or you might say, well, if she's going to be that way about it, heck with her, I'm just not going to even continue in this conversation, and hang up or walk away or whatever it is you're doing. So you can understand that timing has a lot to do with, you know, human conversations as well. Would everybody agree with that?
Yeah, sure.
Yep.
Something else that needs to be considered is access method. Access method kind of dictates when people can send a message. Right now, the access method is, I have the floor because I'm the teacher. Aren't you lucky? And then I'll give it to somebody if I feel like it, or I won't if I don't. But right now, the access method is that I'm being the tyrant or the bad cop, right? Obviously, somebody could decide that they're going to interrupt me, right, and start, you know, sending messages in the chat window. Have I had that happen? Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
And then I'd probably get mad and say, next time I hear somebody pop up in the chat window, I'm going to mute you and be autocratic again. Okay, so access method to determine, you know, how messages can get sent. Sometimes it's a free-for-all. Anybody can say anything they want. You know, how in a room it's a kind of a social gathering or whatever, and people just talk. And sometimes it's far more structured like this. Usually what happens, though, is even when it appears to be a free-for-all, people do try to wait their turn. And what happens, guys, if you start, if somebody's talking, and then everything goes quiet, and then all of a sudden two people start talking at the same time? Have any of you ever seen that happen in a social situation? And what happens? What do people do in that situation?
One usually stops.
Yeah, or they both stop. You know, have you ever seen that where everybody, where both of them start to talk at the same time, and then all of a sudden they both realize, oh crap, this other person's talking, and so they stop, and they kind of look at each other, and they look down, and then, you know, their faces both get a little bit red, and they say, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry. Oh no, go ahead, you go ahead, I'm sorry. And then they kind of back off again, and one person rather sheepishly, you know, decides to start or whatever. It's actually pretty funny, but the same actually occurs during computer communication. Believe it or not. Okay. Hosts on a computer actually need access methods to know when that they can start sending messages and how to respond when an error occurs. Now, let's talk a little bit about flow control. Basically, what that is how much information can be sent and the speed at which it can be delivered. Clearly, if one person speaks very quickly, it can be difficult for the other person to understand the message. I don't know about you, but out here in Arizona, there are a lot of Spanish-speaking people. Now, I speak some Spanish, but I am not very good at Spanish, okay? But sometimes some of these people don't speak any English, in which case you have no other option but to speak to them in Spanish. So I speak in my halting, anglicized, gringo Spanish, and all of a sudden the person comes back to me. I mean, it sounds like a machine gun. I just look at them and my eyes glaze over, and all I can say is, atrasado, por favor, which means, slower, please. because I'm totally messed up. They just spoke so fast that there is no way on God's green earth that I would ever understand what was said. And so it is with, you know, messages sent on a network. Sometimes the host, the sending host, can receive, the sending host can send information at a faster rate. The receiving host can process it. And so this can generate errors, and the sending host has to slow down. So source and destination hosts do use flow control in order to negotiate successful communication. Another area that has to be considered is response timeout. We kind of talked about this a little bit. You know, if I ask a question and everybody sits there and goes, then you assume that either the people didn't hear you, or they're ignoring you, or they don't want to answer, and you react. Hosts on the network also have rules that they have to follow on a network regarding the time to wait for a response and what to do in the event that no response is in fact forthcoming. Okay. So we've already really talked about these. All right, let me talk to you about these diagrams, because they're talking about access method. There's a man and there's a woman. They're trying to communicate with each other. The woman begins the communication by asking the man, what time is the movie? However, the man also starts to talk and is asking the woman, what time are we meeting for dinner? And so the two actually collide with each other at this point. Nobody quite understands what was said, because, you know, each person was asking the other and they were over the top of each other. So both the man and the woman say, oh, sorry, you know, I didn't understand what you said. And then they stop a little bit and they, you know, ask the questions over again, and this time they get their answers. Now, in flow control, to illustrate flow control, the man and the woman are communicating by telephone. And the woman's saying, hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? And the man receives the message, but he doesn't have an opportunity to respond that, you know, he does, in fact, hear. So the man's going, what? Because he doesn't understand why the woman's, you know, doing that. And response timeout is illustrated by the man and the woman again on the telephone. The woman and the man are talking, and the woman says, hello, can you hear me? And the man doesn't say anything. And she repeats it, and the man still doesn't respond. And the same happens. And she decides that this telephone conversation is going absolutely nowhere, and she hangs up the phone. Do you guys understand these concepts of access method and timeout, response timeout and flow control?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, you guys sounded a little tentative. Am I catching that, or?
Oh, for me, it's something I understand, but it's something I'd need to read through again just to be sure.
Yep, but don't hesitate to grab any of us on Skype during the week if you are having problems. If we're about, I'll send us an email and somebody will come back to you if you send an email to the list or something too.
Are the quotes to the carrier sense multiple, whatever that's, I can't remember the...
Carrier sense multiple... Carrier sense... Oh, hang on.
Carrier sense multiple access...
Multiple access with collision detection, that's it. Yeah, that's all quite discussed in the Chapter 3 notes, where one machine will back off, send a back off algorithm, and they'll wait for a sort of varying amount of time, and then one machine will start resending its message, and hopefully have it received.
Yeah, you hope one. Remember, machines are machines, and they're not human, but it can be pretty funny watching people, you know, do this. I mean, we do it all the time, you know. Elise and I'll be talking or whatever. We'll start to interrupt each other and, oh, sorry, and then back off, and then we'll both sit there and be silent, and then, you know, I mean, it's pretty funny to watch people when that happens, because nobody wants to step on the other person's toes, and everybody's a little embarrassed, and it just, yeah, it is pretty funny. Observe the interaction sometimes when it occurs, okay? Don't ever let it be said that Discovery Networking can't teach you something about human behavior.
It's quite funny, isn't it? Very similar.
It is. The next thing we're going to talk about is message patterns. And this is going to touch on the networking concept of unicast, multicast, and broadcast. Okay. So let's talk about this. Sometimes a person wants to communicate information to a single individual, i.e., maybe Elise and I need to have a private conversation, or maybe Elise and Kylie need to have a private conversation, or maybe Kylie and I, or Joe and I, need to have a private conversation. All right. Sometimes, though, we need to send information to a group of people at the same time, like now, or even to all people in the same area, like if there's a tornado warning, okay, then that information needs to be disseminated to all people of the warned area as quickly as possible so that they can take shelter, do whatever it is they need to do in order to protect themselves. A conversation between two people is an example of a one-to-one or unicast pattern of communication. When a group of people need to receive the same communication simultaneously, then that's either called one-to-many, or if all people need to receive it, then that's called a one-to-all pattern of communication. Sometimes a sender has to have acknowledgement that the message is received. You know, like a certified letter, or you know, if you get a letter that you have to sign for, or a package that you have to sign for, this is an acknowledgement that the letter or the message in question, package in question, has been received. In these cases, you know, the recipient has to do something like sign or whatever, so that the sender gets their acknowledgement that the item was received. At other times, it's kind of a fire and forget kind of a situation. Skype and Ventrilo are like that. The packets are not acknowledged. Yeah, it is. If no acknowledgement is required, then the message pattern is referred to as unacknowledged. Hosts on a network also use similar kinds of message pattern. As I said, a one-to-one pattern is referred to as a unicast. By the way, Jaws pronounces it anicast, but it's actually unicast. And it means that there is only a single receiving destination. Okay. When a host needs to send, like, a one-to-many pattern, then it's called a multicast. A perfect example is what we are doing right now, basically. It's the delivery of a message to a group of hosts simultaneously. If every host on the network needs to receive it, then it's a broadcast message, and broadcasting represents a one-to-all message pattern. You find this happening in situations like where a client logs on and they need an IP address, and DHCP server actually assigns that address. The client might broadcast, you know, a message to say who is the DHCP server on the network. And it would go to all hosts on that network, because the client doesn't know where that DHCP server is, for example. Does anybody have any questions about that process? Now, sometimes we talk about a broadcast domain. What a broadcast domain is, all hosts on a particular network segment that would receive a broadcast. Now, we'll get into dividing up of networks a little bit later. But suffice it to say, there are times when, whereas it's a broadcast message, only hosts on that particular network should receive it. It should not go out, for example, on the internet. So, for example, on my little home network here, there may be broadcast traffic sent, okay, but my little home network is the broadcast domain. And when it gets to the router says, wait a minute, this is broadcast traffic. This does not need to go over the internet. This message is getting dumped. I'm not letting it go further. And it goes, pfft. Okay. So that's the concept of a broadcast domain. Now, this is hard, so does anybody have any questions about it? Or at least it can create confusion.
So just clarifying, say you've got a network on 192.168.2.0 to 2.54, so everything on that network is in its own broadcast domain. If it was 192.168.3 something, it would be in a different broadcast domain, is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a good question, Matt, so thanks for asking it, Colin.
So does everybody understand that about the broadcast domain?
Yes.
Joseph, you're being really quiet.
Mr. Joseph, come in, Joseph. Maybe he's nicked out to the kitchen to cook his dinner. How are you going over there, Mario?
I'll have to review it so that it sucks in a little better.
And that's a good way to be. Review it, and even come back to it in a couple of chapters' time, too. You know, you don't necessarily have to be stuck on it. Because these are all new concepts to you guys, and please don't feel embarrassed to ask him to clarify things like Tyler just did. So that's fair enough. And how are you going down there all the way in Texas, Gary? I haven't heard much from you. How's it soaking in? Or you have to, any questions?
That was my next question.
Oh, how's Gary going? Yeah.
Doing fine here.
Again, the same rules apply to you. Yeah, come and talk to us if you've got any issues. Joseph Shanley. Okay, yellow light, no talkies. What's
I think am I okay?
Oh,
I don't
there.
Know.
Here we go.
You think you're all right with it?
I got it, Jackie. I got it. I'm good so far.
All right. Excellent. So, as I mentioned to you earlier, all communication, both human and computer, are governed by established rules or protocols. The protocols are going to be determined by the characteristics of the source and the channel and the destination. You're going to hear these words over and over and over and over again, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Okay? So the protocols are going to define the details for message format, message size, timing, encapsulation, encoding, and standard message patterns. And guess what, Elise? You're up.
Thank you, dear. Well, we've just asked if everyone's coping, so I won't do that. The importance of protocols. And it's all very important stuff. And from this point forward, as Jackie said, you're going to hear all this sort of stuff mentioned and mentioned and mentioned again. Computers, just like humans, use rules or protocols. Yep. Look what happened, as Jackie pointed out, with all the language changes. All the rules changed as well at the tower. So that's it. It was all very unintelligible and no one could understand anybody. No rules, lots of chaos, and here we are.
And nobody got anything done either. A tower never did get built.
And that tower never did get built. So there you go. Talk about divide and conquer, huh? So, So you can imagine the chaos where there's no rules, no language, none of that. So everyone had to go off and learn all these different languages, and we're still coping. So again, this is where, you know, humans and computers do have something in common, because all these rules and things are quite, you know, necessary on the local area network, on any network. In a wide environment, a local area network, it's basically where all hosts must speak the same language. I'll share a common protocol. Does somebody want to mic up?
No, sorry, I didn't mean to press control.
That's okay, no worries. If everyone in the same room spoke a different language, no one would be able to communicate. Likewise, if these devices didn't use the same protocol, they couldn't communicate. The most common set of protocols used on wired networks is, you guessed it, good old Ethernet. Let's hear it for Ethernet. The Ethernet protocol defines many aspects of communications over the network. Basically, as Jackie's mentioned, message format. Jackie's also discussed message size, timing, encoding, and message patterns, all of which Jackie's just talked about. One of these diagrams here depicts three people in a single room, all speaking Japanese. Well, I'm glad they're all speaking Japanese, because if they weren't, they might have trouble understanding each other. So there's a need for a universal protocol to be established between all these parties.
But we would certainly have trouble understanding them, most likely.
Well, exactly. If we turned up in that same room, we would have a lot of problems. Okay, it also talks about another diagram here that depicts four PCs connected through a switch, and the common language is Ethernet. And these guys can all talk to one another. In the early days of networking, however, things were very different. All the vendors had their own protocols. Now, I'm not sure that I should put it out to questions here or not, so I just might mention it. There was AppleTalk, there was Vanyan Bynes, there was Novell Netware, and they all had their own AppleTalk. They all had their own protocols, so it was often difficult to make PCs talk to Macintoshes and that sort of stuff. Essentially, equipment from one vendor couldn't communicate with equipment from other vendors. As networks became more widespread, standards were developed. Of course, standards are very beneficial to networks, of course, because they facilitate design, simplify product development, promote competition, provide consistent interconnections, facilitate training, which is what we're doing now, and provide more vendor choices for customers. Let's hear it for good old Ethernet. There's no official network. Yep.
You guys, I don't know if any of you guys are old enough to remember this, but back in the 80s, I believe, there were a couple of formats of video recorders out there.
Oh, yes.
It was like, VHX and Betamax or something like that.
VHS, Video Home System, and Betamax.
Right.
That's it.
And Betamax, okay. You're right.
Yep.
Yeah. And so what happened? Well, and see, there was this thing. There was this big thing where if you bought a particular video recorder, like that was VHS, you could not play Betamax on it, and vice versa. And there was this huge war going on between the protocols until finally VHS actually won out, I believe. But, you know, I mean, this is what happens when, and the DVD here back in the late 90s, early 2000s, have a similar problem where, you know, there was DVD-R, DVD-RW, DVD-plus-R, DVD-plus-RW, DVD-RAM, DVD-ROM, and some of the DVDs wouldn't play on certain manufacturers' drives. So you can see how important it is to have some standardized protocols for these things. Otherwise, people get stuck buying equipment that can't, you know, work with other equipment.
Yeah, well, I think Kylie alluded to the fact that Betamax was better, and it was. but the market has got there and screwed us all over, so there you go. So it doesn't often necessarily mean that the better technically format is going to win. Incidentally, can anyone not even have to hark back as far back as the 1980s? We had a war recently, and it was recently won. Can anyone think about what that was, a standard war?
That was the Blu-ray war.
You got it, Joe. Blu-ray versus HD DVD. Blu-ray won. Not so. I can't tell you whether it's a better standard or not. I don't think it can hold as much information as the other format.
And I think the only reason why VHS won in the video thing is because it was less expensive, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Silent. Sorry, Carly, did you have to say something?
No, I said the same thing, actually, as Joe.
Oh, okay, gotcha, the DVD one. There was something else that was on my mind too, and I can't quite remember what it was. I'll think of it later. But yeah, standards are the same. I mean, say, they try and put regions into DVDs now so that they won't play on each other's machines. But if you come from down under, that's no longer a problem because we're all multi-region down here now. So, with the networking protocols, there's no official networking protocol, but Ethernet has become more common than the others and is now really the de facto standard. There's a diagram here that depicts the networking protocols that were first designed by companies that were proprietary. Oh, here we go. Yeah, some of these earlier protocols that actually date back to the 1970s were sort of, I guess, from IBM, NCR, Xerox, DEC, and Hewlett-Packard. And as we move through the 1980s, they brought about the standardizations. Such as, here we go, some internet standard, network standards to be aware of. Ethernet, IEEE 802.3, ARCNET 802.4, and Token Ring, which is 802.5, and we'll discuss these as we get further down the chapter. With widespread expansion of the internet in the 1990s, guess who won? Let's hear it for Ethernet, 802.3. 802.3, circa 2000 to be precise. Okay. The Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, pronounced IEEE, are the people who sort of define these standards. They maintain these networking standards, and they're made up of various committees. They also maintain the wireless standards too, which we'll also discuss. These IEEE committees are responsible for coming up with the standards and maintaining them and making sure they meet everybody's requirements and protocols. Each technology is assigned a number that it refers to the committee that is responsible for it, for approving and maintaining the standard. The committee, of course, responsible for the standard is what, guys? I'll tell you. Committee number 802.3. Wow. Oh, since the creation of Ethernet in 1973, since 1973, the creation of Ethernet, the standards have evolved to make it even faster. What's going on here, guys? Okay, we all with us?
You had a glitch there.
We've had a massive glitch, guys. All right. Darkstar must be cratering. You crater, hun?
Oh, I cratered.
Everyone cratered. Oh, I think I got a Gary and Joe off and on. Kylie and I stayed stable, as did Stuart, so maybe there's a problem with our international link.
Wondering.
We all here, folks? Everyone came back, though. I don't think you had to log on, though, did you? Re-log back on?
I had to.
Log me back in.
Oh, did you? You had to log yourself back in. What, you did automatically, or did you put you back on?
Automatically logging me back in. I had a window with voiceover in it.
Yeah, some people got kicked right out.
Yeah, I had that too. My recording died.
I didn't. Oh, I've got two going here, hun. All right, let's hear it for connectivity to Darkstar, hey? All right. Must be an international problem because us Australasians seem to
stay. Yeah, I lost you guys too.
Yeah, everyone in America dropped, I think. Well, glad to know you're still with us, gang. All right, now let's talk about, as I was saying before that.
Put your chat window up, John.
Thanks.
Since
You've
the
really out again, Joe.
Yeah, it's reset his system. So just back off from your microphone if you can't be bothered mucking around. All right. Okay, since the invention of Ethernet in 1973, it's gotten faster, basically, is what they're trying to say here. This ability for Ethernet to improve over time is one of the main reasons for it becoming so popular. Each version of Ethernet has an associated standard, so let's talk about some of those. Okay, so we've got, for example, 802.3 100 base T represents the... Oh, basically, yes, it says here, represents the 100 megabit using twisted pair cable, which is absolutely correct. 100 is the speed in Mbps, and that is capital M, little bps, megabits per second. Base stands for baseband transmission, and T stands for type of cable, in this instance, twisted pair. Early versions of Ethernet were relatively slow at 10 megabits per second, or 10 Mbps. Now we can go all the way to, well, it says here in the notes 10 gigabits faster. I'm not so sure about that. Gigabit Ethernet, which is what I sort of know about. 100 megabits per second is what most people have at the moment. So imagine how much faster these are than the original standard. All right, we've got a timeline here, gang, so here we go. Let's see if we can read this coherently. Okay, 1973, the Ethernet was developed by Dr. Robert McAfee at Xerox Corporation. Okay, 1980, DEC, which is Digital Equipment, Intel, and Xerox all got together and created 10 megabit Ethernet and got it a lot faster. And they did that over coaxial cable. Wow. In 1983, we got the 802.3 standard, which is 10 base 5, it's not reading properly here. 10 base 5, 10 megabit per second Ethernet over a thick coaxial cable. Okay, gotcha. In 1985, we got 802.3A, which is 10 base 2, 10 megabit per second over thin coaxial cable. And in 1990, good year that, was 802.3I, 10 base T Ethernet over twisted pair. That's when we started coming into our twisted pair. Then we started in 1993 going fiber optic, and we got 100, and in 1995 as well, that was also a good year, we got basically 100 megabit per second over twisted pair cable. So there you go, and fiber, various other standards. Oh geez, it goes on quite a bit. Something happened in 1996. Oh, that's when gigabit came out.
Yeah, just scroll down to it.
Yeah. So read your notes, because I'm not expecting you to remember all this. The last thing being actually 2006. 802.3AN, which is 10 based... Oh, 10, oh, there it is, 10 gigabit. There it is. So there you go. 10 gigabit in 2006. All communications require source and destination. Basically, if you're in a room and a name is called, the person with that name is going to respond, and most people will ignore the message. The same thing happens here in computing. So if I was in a room with Kylie and Jackie and Joe and Mario and Stuart and Gary, and I went, "Hey, Gary," most people would ignore it, and Gary would prick his ears up and listen. On Ethernet networks, this same thing happens. On an Ethernet network, we have addressing. And we're about to touch here on physical addressing so that we can identify a particular host on the network. Every network interface has a physical address. We're talking physical address here, guys, assigned to it. And this address is known as the Media Access Control or MAC address. The MAC address identifies each source and destination host on a network. And for those people out there who are still having a little bit of trouble, we're talking layer 2 devices here and talking switches. Okay, Ethernet networks are often cable-based, which means or fiber optic, which means that the copper or fiber optic cable connects hosts with networking devices. This is known as the channel between the hosts. It sends a frame, so remember, associate layer 2 frames and switches, and you're starting to really join the dots here. It basically sends frames containing its own MAC address and the MAC address of the intended recipient. So there you go, we've got both the MAC addresses here in the frames. Any host that receives the frame will decode the frame and look at the MAC address. If the destination MAC address matches the address on its own NIC, the computer will process that frame on message and, you know, basically store it and, you know, hand it over to the application to use. If the destination MAC address does not match this particular host's MAC address, the NIC will ignore the message. So there you go. We're not going to listen to it. Okay, is that principle and also relating it back to the room full of people and me yelling out, hey, Gary, is this being understood by folks?
Yeah.
Right, well, I'll try and get through this as quick as possible. Now, I might skip this diagram, Jay. It's going to be very, very hard for me to correlate this into speech. Or should I, Jay? What do you think?
It's up to you.
Oh, here we go. Well, look, I'm not going to read all the MAC addresses because it's all too hard to correlate, but basically there's a diagram here with four computers surrounding a hub. There's H1, H2, H3, H4. H1 is the source, H3, or host 3, is the destination. So H1 goes, well, I want to send a message to H3. The message transmits to all hosts on the network. And there's basically a text box here indicating the parameters of the framing, and this could be very, very difficult to translate.
Well, yeah, look, here. Basically what the frame contains is the destination address and the source address. It also contains the data, which is the encapsulated data. So that's basically what it's saying is that the frame contains is the source MAC address, the destination MAC address, and the data.
Yeah, so that's it. And then, you know, host 3 goes, this is mine, and I'm going to read it.
And host 2 and host 4 say, not mine.
Not mine, don't want to know about it. Okay, so with the Ethernet communications, this Ethernet defines many, many aspects, and some of these other aspects are frame format, frame size, timing, and encoding, which is what this course is all about. When messages are sent between hosts, the messages are formatted into the frame layout, which is specified by the standard. And frames can often be referred to as protocol data units or PDUSs. PDUs, yeah. There you go.
Sounds almost filthy, doesn't it?
Yeah, get PDU. Yeah, exactly. Well, PDU. Could be worse. POQ, I suppose. Sorry, Joe, we've lost Joe again. So it basically says here the source and destination MAC addresses are part of the format. There's also preamble here in the standard for sequence and timing, start of frame delimiter, length and type of frame, and frame check sequence to detect transmission errors. Okay, the size of Ethernet frames is limited to a size of 15-18 bytes and a minimum size of 64 bytes. Frames that do not match these limits are not processed by the receiving host. Basically, the other things that are defined in the standard are the way that these bits are transmitted onto the channel. Bits are transmitted as either electrical impulses over copper cable or light impulses over fibre optic. Okay, here's the structure of the Ethernet frame from left to right. Okay, the first thing is the preamble, which is 7 bytes, which define the pattern of alternating ones and zeros. The start of frame delimiter, or the SFD, which is 1 byte that marks the start of the... Oh, God, it's hard to read this. One byte marks the end of frame timing information and start of the frame. The destination MAC address, which has got 6 bytes. The destination MAC address can be a unicast, multicast, or broadcast address. Another 6 bytes for the source MAC address and the address of the node that transmitted the data. The length and type, 2 bytes. A byte value indicates which protocol will receive data. The length and number that follows this field. So it gets a bit technical here. I don't think you need anything for this test from memory. Okay, the encapsulated data itself, 46 to 1500 kilobytes, which is the payload and size in of requirements stipulate between 64 and... Oh, bloody hell. It's just making a mess with speech, it really is. I would say read your notes on this. We have a check frame sequence, SCF. Oh, here we go. In this instance, we've got a 4-byte value that... here, 4 bytes that contains a... Oh, it's just not reading well with speech. Sorry, gang.
Basically, it's created by the device that created it, and it's recalculated by the receiving device to check it for damage.
Yep, it's about the best way of rephrasing that. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate that.
You know what? Ask me why I'm reading it in WordPad.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know why, it's just very difficult.
I don't know, but Microsoft Word just...
I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm not concentrating so well today, I don't know. Imagine how difficult it would be if the only way to send a message to someone was to use the person's name. What happens if there were no street addresses, cities or towns? You know, there's probably an awful lot of Jackies in the world, an awful lot of Elises, and an awful lot of Kylies. How are we going to get the right one? On the Ethernet network, the MAC address is similar to a person's name. So it indicates the individual identity of a specific host, but doesn't actually indicate where they happen to be. Okay, if all hosts on the Internet were only identified by their unique MAC address, imagine how difficult it would be to locate a single host. Okay, all this additionally, this amount of technology generates an awful lot of broadcast traffic just to communicate. Because, you know, broadcast traffic, of course, is sent to all hosts within a single network. So imagine the more hosts you've got, the more noise and traffic and the more risk of, you know, messages being garbled. Broadcasts also consume bandwidth and slow network performance. Imagine if everybody was attached to one Ethernet on the Internet. It would be a slow old place, I can tell you. For these reasons, large Ethernet networks are not efficient. So it's better to start dividing them down into smaller, more manageable chunks. Now, the best way to do that is to use a hierarchical design model. Okay, I'm going to skip the... No, I won't skip the diagram. This is actually important. There's a diagram here that depicts a map of the world, mainly focused on the continent of North America. The message, the diagram then zooms into Canada to indicate that we're actually looking to talk to somebody in Canada. We can also see specific borders to countries like, you know, the continental United States to the south of Canada. So, of course, there's boundaries to countries as there are boundaries in addressing. This sort of stuff is known as hierarchical addressing. The image zooms again, and this time it zooms in on Nova Scotia, which is a province of Canada. The town of Halifax is shown next, and a specific location, namely a house address, is then shown. So, therefore, we're looking for somebody in a street in Nova Scotia, which is a province of Canada, which is in the Northern American landmass. Same thing applies to when we're talking about the hierarchical structure of IP addressing. I could send a letter to Jackie, for example, and there might be numerous houses in America with the same street number. But I need to put down the fact that she's in Sun City, Arizona, and with the appropriate postcode. And for me, the appropriate country, so that, you know, that both the Australian and the American Postal Service know that it's destined for the United States, Arizona, and her particular place in Arizona. So, in the same thing as the postal system, only traffic, like if I send a letter within Australia, I don't have to write Australia on it. If I sent a letter to Kylie in New Zealand, I generally write New Zealand. And if I send one to Jackie, I generally write United States. So, if I'm sending a letter here to somebody in Australia, I would put the state. I still put the state, even if it's within the state, but we always put the state. And we don't actually have to put the country if we're just sending a message to within a letter to inside Australia. Similarly, messages that are bound for the same network usually stay within that network. Now, is everyone understanding that sort of concept?
Yes.
Thanks, Stuart. Did anyone else want a mic up there?
Are you tracking your time, Lee?
I know, hon. All this allows for increased efficiency, optimization of function, and increased speed. Yeah, good. This also allows the network to scale if required without impacting performance. Okay, now here's where we're going to talk about three basic layers, and we might get to the end of this today if we're lucky. Okay, the curriculum talks about the access layer, which provides access to hosts in the local area network. The distribution layer, which interconnects smaller networks, and a core layer, which is a high-speed connection between distribution layer devices. Now, all this can get a bit iffy for older people like myself, because they're all this weird new terminology, but we will learn more about it as Chapter 3 goes on. Let's get this back. Okay, with this new hierarchical design, there's a need for a logical addressing system that can identify the location of a host. This is known as the Internet Protocol, or IP. Now, we just drop back a little bit back into network topologies. Oh, we're out of time. Okay. I think we're going to stop here because this chapter is just hard, unless anyone's got questions. Do we want to stop here, Jay? I'll go a little bit over.
No, I think we're at a good stopping point.
All right, well, we're just about to talk about IP. Jackie's actually rearranged a bit to talk a little bit about topology here too, so I think if I put some stars here, we can save the document and resume in our little digression.
Well, we can talk about it, you know, next time or whatever, but, I mean, you know, wherever you want to put that, it was just kind of...
Well, we hope to get through... Yeah, I know, you had to move it, didn't you? So, Jackie and I do this. We're almost through chapter 3.3.6. So, we didn't quite get as far as we would like, but it is a hard slog, gang. It really is. It's not easy, this chapter. So, we're halfway up the first incline, and then we'll level out a bit for chapter 4, and then we'll go on another incline again for chapter 5, the two lectures. And then it's all downhill from there, gang. So, we're well into the thick of discovery, gang. So, are you still breathing?
Actually, I like to think of the frame structure a little bit like a memo rather than a letter, because you've got date, which might be a little bit analogous to time to give a bit of a license, and then two, which is your destination address and from, which is your source.
Well, if you enclosed a memo in an envelope, you'd be good.
That's it, because we talk about the what's inside a frame next week, I think. We talk about routers actually being able to undo the frame and look at the packets. Maybe the packets of the sentences or the words.
If you guys need help with any of this, let either Elise or myself know, and we'll happily help if we can.
Yep, and guys, you have our permission to get this wrong. You really, really do. I know what it was like when Jackie and I were learning this. It was quite hard. So we are giving you the permission to come to get it wrong and come and ask questions. And some of you have privately have discussed it, and we often put feedback in the worksheets just to guide you people right, because we want you to pass. We really do. So if you get it wrong, come talk to us. That's good. That's what we want.
Yeah, better to make the mistakes in the classroom than in the on the job.
So I'd like to thank you for all your hard work putting this together, Jackie, because you've done most of it this week. So thanks for that, and because it's been a hard slog, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, no problem.
Any questions?
But I got another class to teach tomorrow, so.
No, you've got to get on with that. That's why I was. I was thinking, oh, well, I'll probably end up helping out on this, but you stepped in and took both classes. So there you go.
Any questions about this, guys, or, you know, do you guys think do you guys feel like Moses seeing, you know, God on Mount Sinai or something?
Oh, no, I think I've pretty much got it, most of it now.
Yep. Now, some of you started putting in worksheets. I've noticed a couple of you haven't. I'm not going to mention any names. My advice would be for you guys to rocket through those chapters 1 and 2 worksheets. Compared to this, it's far easier. And that way you can spend some time concentrating on this, because this is where your concentration is going to be taken up from this point forward. Chapters 3 and 5 are hard. So cut yourself a bit of slack, get that easier stuff done first.
It's not so much that they're hard, it's just that they contain a lot of new concepts, guys. And whenever you have new concepts, the learning curve gets a little steeper, that's all.
So we're halfway up the first of the two inclines on our railway journey to discovery. So there you go, the discovery train is really going now.
Yeah, get on board.
Well,
all right, guys, see you next week.
Thanks for coming, everybody, and see you next week, I guess. I'll talk to you all in between on Skype. And thanks for your help, Jay. It's been great.
Cool.
Okay, thanks, everybody. See you next week.